It's finally happened. President Trump wasn't bluffing. Israel and America have struck Iran. Where is this leading? And does this mean that our forecast was wrong? Well, we'll find out on today's Trumpet World. Welcome to Trumpet World. We've got a bit of a panel here with Mihailo Zekic and Andrew Miller to talk about the attack. We'll bring in Jeremiah Jacques and the perspective from Asia a little later. But to start, Mihailo, could you give us a rundown of the major events of Israel and America's attack on Iran?
Yes, in the early hours of February 28th, Israel and the United States launched a surprise bombing campaign against Iran, which targeted Tehran specifically and claimed, among others, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei as a casualty. But other important sites, like some of the nuclear sites struck last year, security sites in Kurdish areas were and still are also being heavily struck. Iran retaliated a number of ways. They tried to close the Strait of Hormuz. They've declared it closed, at least. The United States is promising safe passage to any vessels sailing through there. And they also launched a barrage of missiles against Israeli targets, against American targets, but also against America's allies in the Gulf states, like the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, which has prompted a lot of ire among those countries. And in the case of Qatar, has even reportedly staged its own bombing campaign in Iran, though that isn't as highly publicized. The Assembly of Experts, the committee that is tasked with selecting the next supreme leader, met in the Iranian city of Qom, and Israel promptly bombed the building. There are differing reports as to how successful that was, but they reportedly are leaning towards choosing Mojtaba Khamenei, Ali Khamenei's son, as the next supreme leader. That hasn't been confirmed yet, and the assembly may be scared of confirming that because Israel said whoever they're going to choose, they're going to strike him anyway. President Trump said that he doesn't support him. We've also seen Kurdish groups from Iraqi Kurdistan saying that they're willing to basically cross the border into Iran to help liberate their Kurdish brothers, and that the United States will support them. One of the scariest incidents, I think, of this war thus far is 2 days ago. Iran launched a missile that apparently was aiming for Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, which is a joint U.S.-Turkish air base and where the U.S. keeps its nuclear weapons in Turkey. And Turkey obviously didn't like that, but that could have gone very, very wrong if things played out differently. Hezbollah, the Lebanese terror group that's one of Iran's most important proxies, they launched a bombing campaign into Israel as soon as Israel struck Iran, and Israel retaliated with another ground invasion, very limited compared to the one in 2024. But they are in the process of dismantling Hezbollah again in southern Lebanon, and the Lebanese government has declared all of Hezbollah's military activity banned. They said that before and they didn't follow through, but this time it sounds they may be more serious about that. One last important story that I'm sure you'll be touching on a little bit later. Iran also attacked a British airbase in Cyprus that reportedly was involved in intelligence gathering for the attack. And Britain had a struggle in defending that. Cyprus wasn't too happy and called on the rest of the EU, and the EU jumped to it. You've had Greece, France, other countries, basically Russian and EU armada to protect Cyprus, and said that they would get more involved as necessary. So a lot of things happening in a lot of different parts of the Middle East. Basically, the entire region is involved, and it's only been less than a week since the conflict started.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. Let's bring Andrew Miller in now. And Andrew, do you have anything to add in terms of from the English-speaking world, the American perspective of the significant events of that attack and what we've seen over the past week?
Yes. Well, President Trump, he's been pretty clear what his objectives are. He wants to destroy Iran's nuclear program. He wants to destroy Iran's intercontinental ballistic program. Both of those things are obviously huge threats, not just to Israel, but to other nations in the Middle East and even to the United States. And he's also looking for regime change in Tehran. And when he says regime change, he's not talking about George W. Bush-style regime change, where you actually wipe out the government and try to start over with a new Jeffersonian democracy in the Middle East that just really comes up with a lot of chaos. He's been pretty overt in that he wants someone from inside the regime. Like, he wants another supreme leader of Iran. So there will still be, if Trump gets his way, a supreme leader of Iran. But he definitely wants a role in picking that supreme leader. It's similar to what he did in Venezuela, where he arrested the president and then promoted the vice president to president and is now making mineral deals with that guy. Or even what he's trying to do in Cuba, where he's trying to get the president to step down and get a more moderate, business-minded person. He wants a more a reformist-minded person in Iran to take over. There's some logic to that. I've been looking into it this week for a potential infographic for our next print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet. And as close as there are entire firms that are dedicated to like analyzing the political situation in Iran. The current thought is that about 20% of Iranians, like 18 million Iranians, support the Islamic Republic, but 70% oppose it. And even amongst the clerics, there's roughly 200,000 mullahs or clerics in Iran. About a third of them support the regime. 10% oppose it, and then the majority of clerics are just apolitical. So there's plenty of reformers to choose from. The big question everybody needs to answer now is, does the United States actually have the ability to get one of these reformers in power? Because President Trump, in conjunction with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, has taken some very bold action to bring about this regime change in Iran. At least on President Trump's part, he is in a constitutional gray area in that Congress has not declared war on Iran. Congress has not even approved military strikes on Iran. He's basically using the 1974 War Powers Act, which gives the president 60 days to unilaterally take military action against imminent threats to America. Starting that Iran's nuclear program is an imminent threat. And so taking action based on that, which that law, at least under its current interpretation, does give the president some pretty broad and sweeping powers to take actions like this. But you can only go so far without congressional approval. Opinion polls indicate that only about 25% of Americans support this war. The Republican Party is heading into midterm elections in about 8 months. Almost all the Democrats, with maybe one or two exceptions, oppose the war. Even one or two more libertarian-minded Republicans oppose the war. And so Trump doesn't have the diplomatic support for a prolonged war in Iran, which is why he's telling people, we're going to get this taken out in 4 weeks. And if he takes bold action, he might be able to really decimate Iran's nuclear program and Iran's intercontinental ballistic, and Iran's missile program in those 4 weeks. The tricky part is the regime change, in that the fact that in a war like this, Iran's Islamic Revolution, despite probably only having the support of 20% of the population, is supported by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is equally powerful to the Iranian military, and by most estimates controls about 50% of Iran's economy. So massively powerful guard corps. And if you don't root out that guard corps completely, which is not something that you're going to be able to do in 4 weeks, root out the Guard Corps completely. If you don't root out that Guard Corps completely, the end of this campaign could be worse than the beginning. In that, under the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran was an Islamic theocracy run by mullahs who feel some responsibility of making sure that Iran is run according to the tenets of Shia Islam. For a while now, there's been a number of analysts saying that, like, as Iran comes under pressure, that the Guard Corps could actually take precedence over the Assembly of Experts. Mihailo mentioned earlier that they're actually looking at getting Khomeini's son as the next Supreme Leader. Donald Trump definitely doesn't want that. I think even people in the Assembly of Experts have some reservations about that. He's not a high-ranking mullah. He is a mullah, but not a high-ranking one. So his main power base is the Guard Corps. So if that happens, you could definitely see Iran transitioning into more like a military dictatorship than an Islamic theocracy, where you're run by this Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is definitely the most hardline and most extreme part of the Iranian government right now, even compared to the Assembly of Experts and some of their more clerical institutions.
Yes, let's transition into talking about what happens next. And for us and our expectations of what happens next, what happens in the Middle East, that is absolutely informed by Bible prophecy. And we've had a lot to say about Iran because of that Bible prophecy. So, Mihailo, I guess you deal with the Middle East. Maybe you could just run down for us, just in general, what has our forecast been for Iran, and why is that so important?
Yes, the go-to prophecy is in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, which reads, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. He shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." Now, this is an end-time prophecy. You could read the context in the rest of the chapter. It's about war between great powers over the Middle East, and it involves two power blocks, which, since the 1990s, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has identified this king of the south pushing for control of the Middle East, pushing for control over the Holy Land, as verse 41 brings out, as being Iran and its radical Islamist allies. And because of that, we've watched for Iran to take a few directions. A, we're looking for a pushy provocation against the West, specifically against Catholic Europe. That is the king of the North, as Mr. Fleury and as Mr. Fleury has said as well. We're looking for Iran to become king of the Middle East, to be the overarching dominant power of the anti-Western Islamist bloc. If you keep reading the passage, it talks about other countries the king of the North conquers, which implies they're allied with Iran. That includes Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia. We're expecting Iran to build its proxy empire, specifically in those countries, though not exclusively. And we're expecting Iran to be such a belligerent, malignant threat that Europe has no choice but to go all out with the whirlwind, that Iran's actions will draw Europe in to attack Iran. Now, if you look at the current war, again, Khomeini's dead. Iran looks like it's teetering on the brink of revolution, possibly. One can look at that and go, well, Iran's not going to be the king of the south anytime soon. Iran is already losing the proxies it already has. We've talked about that plenty of times last year. How is this going to happen?
I mean, that's exactly... There are people looking at it that way. Here's a comment from our YouTube channel this week. "The prophecies they think they've been prophesying aren't coming true. Germany and Europe didn't come at Iran like a whirlwind." And if this is Donald Trump, just a few minutes ago, he said he wanted unconditional surrender in Iran. if this is now the end of Iran as a theocracy and the beginning of Iran as a Western-style democracy, and that Iran is now going to be remade in the image of the United States, then, well, yeah, how could it fulfill its role as the King of the South? But we're not there yet, even like we heard from Andrew. And there are a lot of very good reasons to think we won't get there. And then you bring in Bible prophecy, and we know that isn't going to happen. Here's what Mr. Hilliker wrote in the article that we had up on the weekend. It was adapted from an article he had 6 months ago during the 12-day war, where you had similar questions and people making similar statement. Well, how can Iran be the King of the South? They're being pummeled by America. And he points out there several details of the King of the South prophecy have already been fulfilled. He says, as you can read in the King of the South, our booklet on that, prophecy accurately told us to expect Iran to lose its influence over Gaza. Israel's success over Hamas accomplished this. Prophecy foretold Lebanon slipping from Iran's orbit. Israel's neutering of Hezbollah paved the way for this to occur. Prophecy also said Iran would lose Syria. That was dramatically fulfilled when the Assad regime fell in December. December of 2024, I guess that was. It goes on to say, now prophecy tells us to expect Iran to build a new axis of resistance with Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. This is no minor achievement. It will require strength, authority, and strategic coherence from the Iranians. So we're not expecting Iran to be completely pulverized. And he writes there, prophecy shows the recent offensive against Iran will fail to eliminate the threat. It also shows that this failure will serve as a potent example to another power on how to attack Iran and succeed. So, you know, we had our interview on Wednesday with Alon Levy, and I thought it was a really interesting interview. He had a lot of great things to say. I think particularly his points on anti-Semitism, his points about how pathetic the British government have been on this were very good, very pertinent. I didn't, as you might have been able to tell from the interview, I didn't really agree on his very sunny view that this is it, that Donald Trump is going to stick this out and that we're going to see the end of the Iranian theocracy. And part of that is we feel like we've been here quite a few times before. You know, you think back to the Arab Spring, and so you've got big protests in Egypt, and the media is all over in Egypt, and the impression that you get from the media is that Egypt is absolutely chock full of people that want an American-style democracy in Egypt. And yeah, there were some like that, and those people were the ones that made good television. You know, they're the ones that spoke English. Those were the ones that hung around in the same places as the journalists, in this case with Iran, because you don't really have many journalists on the ground. These are the ones making TikTok videos celebrating the fall of Ayatollah Khamenei. But the majority of the Iranian people aren't on TikTok, and they don't speak English, and they've been living for 40 years under an indoctrinated theocracy, being brought up by teaching, controlled by a lot of these pretty radical clerics. That's not something that you turn around overnight. So, you know, that's one reason to expect Iran to continue. Even if Donald Trump may insist on unconditional surrender, he also, he said, well, we'll be able to send boots on the ground if possible. Seeing is believing, and I don't think America certainly isn't up for a kind of massive ground invasion. But ultimately, the big reason why we're really expecting no massive turnaround here or a Western-style democracy is that prophecy that you've just been explaining to us in Daniel chapter 11.
Yes, for comments like the one you read out, I get reminded of there's a section in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar where Caesar is walking to the Capitoline Hill, and he meets the soothsayer that prophesied, "Beware the Ides of March." And he tells the soothsayer, "Well, the Ides of March are here." And the soothsayer replies, "Well, they're not gone yet." So nothing's been settled right now. Even if you want to bring a few other facts on the ground on why people shouldn't be as optimistic that this is the start of change. I mentioned earlier that President Trump is considering arming Kurdish groups. We've talked before about how boots on the ground apparently mean Kurdish boots on the ground. Like you said, we've been here before plenty of times. In Syria, our boots on the ground were Kurdish groups, and we've discussed at the Trumpet on how President Trump has just left them hanging out to dry in the face of the new Shia government over there. The Kurds always seem to be the best fighting force possible. America makes a big deal about them. And then Turkey comes up and saying, well, we're not going to support you supporting Kurdish groups because we don't like the Kurds. And then they get the rugs pulled from under them. And even just historically, if you look at perspectives, what's going on in Iran right now actually reminds me a lot of what we saw in the Soviet Union in the late 80s and the early 90s, where, okay, maybe the leadership at the top was too top-heavy. Maybe people were tired of how horrible the economy was. They wanted to live a better life. They wanted some change. They got plenty of turbulent years of change. And then you get Vladimir Putin coming up and a lot of his supporters saying, well, okay, this experiment with Western ideals didn't work out for us. We're going to fix some of the mistakes of the old guys, but we're going to keep being the aggressive, belligerent power that we always were. And eventually most of the population comes to support that.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you look at the unconditional surrender that Donald Trump is calling for today, and you look at, well, when was the last time America really achieved that? I mean, I guess the Iran war, the Afghanistan war, even in those cases where America achieved unconditional surrender, well, I don't know whether, I mean, for say the Taliban, I don't know if they ever did surrender, but at least America took over the whole country with a large amount of number of troops, a lot of people dead, years of fighting. But the Taliban are in power in Afghanistan to this day. You look at, you know, the biggest example of unconditional surrender, this was Germany and Japan after World War II, the effort that that took to get there. There's not the will to do that again today. So the idea, like turning around an entire country like this, yes, there are significant kind of Western elements there, and there are Kurds that lean towards the West. Like, I don't want to say that they're not there at all in Iran, but we also can't ignore that there's a lot of very religious fundamentalists, and we tend, like, there's just a lot of blind spots in the Western thinking, or we, like, assumptions, you know, this kind of arc of history idea, you know, the end of history idea, that we are on a path, that mankind is on almost a scripted journey, and the end of that journey is a liberal Western-style democracy, and anything moving in that direction is progress, and this is the direction that everyone will inevitably end up. And a lot of people look at Iran in that lens. We've had a revolution. Well, this is the logical, inevitable result. A democracy is advanced and sophisticated. A theocracy is backwards. Therefore, the democracy will automatically replace the theocracy. And all we need to do is kill the Ayatollah, and that's it. You know, the way history itself will continue to roll forwards and produce that desired result.
Which is what a lot of people, at least similar things, were saying in 1979 when the Shah was ousted. You had, like you were saying, you had the people in front of the cameras, you had everybody excited, this is the beginning of the end, and this is how the Iranian, the Islamic Republic started. So even, especially when the regime itself is still, okay, the top guy's up, but as Andrew mentioned, the IRGC's still there. Like, even, like, to declare that Iran is on its last legs and freedom is breathing when the regime hasn't even surrendered yet and shows no signs of doing that is extremely premature.
Yeah, I think one thing that's good for people to remember about the Kurds as well is this is a specific ethnic group in Iran that lives in the northwest corner of the country. That's fighting for their own state, like an independent Kurdistan. So I feel like with the Kurds, like the best case scenario, this may not happen, but like the best case scenario is you basically have a fairly small province of Iran break away from the rest of the main of the country. But the Persian core of the country, it's like 60-something percent of Iranians are Persian, and they all live in that central plateau. They're not worried about the Kurds displacing their government. So this is a regional part of Iran that could weaken the central government a little bit. But like, as I did, even if the Kurds broke away, that doesn't necessarily mean the other 90% of Iran isn't going to remain an Islamist dictatorship under the control of the IRGC.
That's a good point. And just sticking with you, Andrew, I think one of the things we've also seen over the last week is the divides within President Trump's internal coalition, where you've got people like Tucker Carlson, who are just absolutely livid about this attack. But it's not just Tucker Carlson. There are more moderate branches. I've noticed the American conservative in particular has become more and more upset as the week has gone on about this attack. Like some of it, if you look at Tucker Carlson, say, it's just kind of unhinged and anti-Semitic. And we talked about that on our show on Wednesday with Alon Levy. I think, though, there's others that isn't anti-Semitic and unhinged. It's just they don't like it. And there's memories of Iraq and getting involved there. So, and how serious is the split within MAGA? How, you mentioned, most, only 25% or 30% around there seem to support the bombings. I mean, how serious are the divisions within the United States here?
Well, I feel like that poll I mentioned before said probably only about 25% of Americans support this attack on Iran. And that number's fairly low because the Democrats, who are against whatever President Trump does, are all against it. Within the Republican Party, the divides, according to the polling data at least, is more like 50-50. 50% of Republicans supporting it, or maybe a little over 50%, and then like 40-something percent opposing, which does highlight the fact that there's definitely two wings of the Make America Great Again movement, even represented by probably President Trump's like two closest advisors. Trump said several times before that he feels that, like, after he's off the scene, that either J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio are his natural successor as the leader of the Make America Great Again movement. Marco Rubio is definitely the guy he's working with when he's arresting people in Venezuela and pushing for regime change in Cuba and pushing for regime change in Iran. J.D. Vance has historically kind of been Trump's liaison to Tucker Carlson and the one who's more representative of the isolationist move, isolationist wing of the MAGA brand. So Vance, he isn't a raging anti-Semite like Tucker Carlson is. Tucker Carlson's out there saying that, like, America's controlled by Netanyahu and this is really a secret attempt to, like, rebuild the third temple on the Islam's third holiest site and all sorts of weird conspiracy theories. I think he's losing some of his influence. But J.D. Vance does definitely speak for those Americans, some of them rightly so, who have realized that every time we've gotten involved in a war in the Middle East in the past 50 or so years, it hasn't ended well. And in even that is actually one of the late Herbert W. Armstrong's signature prophecies. As he said back during the Korean War in the 1950s that because America had turned away from God, that World War II was going to be its last military victory. And so since then, like I said, the Korean War ended in a stalemate. Vietnam War was just an abject defeat. Some of the Gulf Wars looked like victories initially and then realized that actually it just created a bunch more turmoil in the region. So some of these Americans, whether they're familiar with Herbert Armstrong's prophecy or not, are definitely can see that America has not had a military victory in decades. some of the relevant Bible verses and the blessings and cursings in chapter of the Bible, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, talks about strength being spent in vain. So that's actually another prophecy we can use to like predict the outcome of this war. So far, we've been relying mostly on Daniel 11, saying that like, well, if Iran's the head of radical Islam and the radical Islamists have to push against Europe, then America can't create a Western democracy in Islam. It would counter that prophecy and make no sense. But there's also a prophecy that like said, unless America turns back to God, which it hasn't done, like I said, I will break the pride of your power and your strength will be spent in vain. And you look back at Iraq and you look back at Afghanistan and we've spent trillions of dollars and thousands of lives and really got nothing for it in the end. The Taliban still runs Afghanistan. Iraq's as radical as it's ever been. And so unless you see like a huge improvement in the moral character of the American people, this Iran war is just another example of like we're spending a lot of strength. We've got a lot of strength that we've spent already in Iran and that we're continuing to spend in Iran. But that cursing is strength spent in vain, which indicates that, like I said, yeah, you'll spend a lot of strength. And the likely result is probably that you defeat some of the more moderate elements of the Iranian regime. And then the only part that survives this war, the IRGC, the most hardline part, is the one that becomes much more belligerent towards Europe in the future.
Yeah, it's a good point about those prophecies and those blessings and cursings in Leviticus. And I wrote about this week. I had an article, Why American Tech Can't Win Wars. I was going back to that, to Mr. Flurry or Mr. Armstrong's article that he wrote in 1961, I think it was. It was shortly after the Bay of Pigs invasion, where that's where probably he elaborated the most on why America has won its last war. And he really focused on what Leviticus 26 says about God saying, I'm going to break the pride of your power, that as a result of our sin, as a result of our disobedience, this is one of the cursings that God has put on the nation. The nation lacks the will to win. And that's exactly what you saw in South Korea, where America had the ability to win the Korean War. It's, there was... you look back, just about all of the generals, they were convinced that they could have won. However, it would have taken either the use of a nuclear bomb or a death toll starting to approach that of World War II. And neither of that was acceptable to the American people, to the president. It was the kind of, Truman was stuck a bit because he felt like, well, I can't ask this many American soldiers to be conscripted and then to die when I could end this all with a nuclear bomb and not have any Americans die from that. But then, and that's completely you can understand somebody in that position not wanting to press the trigger, though, and he didn't want to use the bomb, and it kind of, America was just stuck. So I think you can see that's the position from then on out, where America just wasn't willing to pay the price to win these wars. And throughout these wars, America's looked to things like technology, like arming locals, like the Kurds, and working with local partners, those in Korea, those in Vietnam. They've looked at uses of special forces as kind of a way to win wars without the cost. And it hasn't worked. And Mr. Armstrong talked about science being a false messiah. He talked about that quite a lot. And I think you see this in war. We look to science to solve so many of our problems. People look to science to solve problems of poverty, problems of disease, science to bring peace, science to win wars. And in the long run, it doesn't work on those things. We trust in technology. And that's what you're seeing in Iran as well. Technology is a way to shortcut the fact that we don't want to pay the price. And the answer to, well, how to win these, there is a way to win these victories without massive death. And it's there in Leviticus 26. as well. It's there in the start of that chapter when God doesn't list the curses, but he lists the blessings. And he says that while just a few of you are going to, you know, 5 of you shall chase 100, 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. There is a way to win wars with small numbers of troops and without massive death and massive American losses. There is a way for America to be protected without hundreds of thousands of American soldiers dying. And it's trust in God. But that doesn't sound practical. That sounds bizarre. That sounds crazy to us today. So we don't go that way. Our pride has been broken. And so we end up with these inconclusive wars. And Mr. Armstrong was so bold and clear in that article. He said, the real blame for the Cuban debacle is on you, all of you. He's writing in the early 60s. You have departed from your living God. You are worshiping at the shrine of pleasure, luxurious living, material interests. You are in a moral toboggan slide. And although your lands are full of churches wherein you conduct pagan worship, your lands are also full of fornication and adultery, full of crime, of vanity, greed, and selfishness, full of lying, dishonesty, and graft, full of cheating, stealing, and murder, full of injustice in your courts. He said in that article, you profess to be God's people. You mention him in your prayers. And that's happening probably much less now than it did in the 60s. But not in sincerity or in truth. You have a form of godliness in your churches and synagogues, but you deny the power of God and fail utterly to rely on it. Your preachers preach lies and you love to have it so. And so we've got this situation where a parallel passage to Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, God says, well, your high-fenced walls, wherein you trusted, well, they're all going to come down. And we have all of these high fence walls and modern technology, and we trust in that false Messiah for protection and for safety. And then we completely ignore all of God's laws, or we change the teachings of the Bible to suit what we would like them to say, instead of looking in the Bible and saying, well, what does it actually say? And God says that approach cannot and will not work. And so, like you say, well, we know that Iran isn't going to work from Daniel 11, but we can look at the blessing and cursings chapters and know ultimately that it won't work. And I think we can credit Donald Trump for having some willpower. And you know, he has done what American presidents have failed to do for decades. He's stood up to Iran in a way that no one else has. And I think we can give him credit for that, while also acknowledging that if God is not behind it, and if we're not really repenting and changing, then it's not going to go all the way. It's not going to finish the job, and we're not going to have total victory. So Mihailo, maybe what we can move on to now, okay, we know that what we've talked about what's going to happen. We've talked about what Bible prophecy says. We can still see, even in the events of the last week, several fulfilled pieces of Bible prophecy already. And one of the most straightforward, one of the most significant of those, comes in the way that Iran has lashed out against much of the Arab world, with missiles going into many of its neighboring countries. So what can you tell us about that and how that fulfills Bible prophecy?
Well, it helps fulfill Bible prophecy tremendously. If you look at the reaction, it seems as if Iran gave a more aggressive attack to these Arab countries than it even did to Israel itself directly in the opening first couple of days of the war. Iran sent something like over 500 drones, almost 200 ballistic missiles, if memory serves me right, just to the United Arab Emirates alone. Hitting some really famous landmarks in Dubai, hitting the building that has the Israeli embassy in Abu Dhabi. There were targets in Qatar against the international airport over there, against civilian infrastructure. Saudi Arabia had its biggest oil refinery attacked. And there are and other countries again, like Kuwait, Oman, Jordan even, they all received attention from Iran as well. And this is, I think, a very revealing attack on how Iran plans on weathering this out. One analyst I heard from said that if you think about how close President Trump is with all these countries, with Qatar especially, we've talked about, Iran knows they have his ear, and they're figuring if they can punch this soft underbelly enough, and they're going to whisper things in his ear, and he's going to call things off. And also, again, with the attack on the oil infrastructure, closing the Strait of Hormuz, That's going to jack up gasoline prices. That's going to jack up energy prices overall. And that's going to hurt the American electorate in a midterm election year coming up, which is something President Trump probably has at least in the back of his mind. But the attacks themselves aren't as noteworthy as the Arabs' response to these attacks. The UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, they have all immediately directly blamed Iran for attacking them. They haven't really said much about the US or even Israel starting a war, which contrasts with what we were seeing last year with Operation Rising Lion and some of the statements they made then. They immediately blamed Iran. They said it's unacceptable. They said they have every right to defend themselves, and they have defended themselves. Both Qatar and Kuwait have shot down Iranian aircraft. I believe Kuwait did as well. And Qatar reportedly, as I mentioned, even did a bombing campaign in Iran itself, and rumors are the UAE could follow suit and directly target Iran's ballistic missile infrastructure. And these countries have released joint statements basically saying the same thing. They're all in the same league with each other. I like to say Iran's done basically the impossible and united the Arab world a common cause that doesn't happen to be Israel. And another prophecy we go to on this program is in Psalm 83, which discusses a lot of these other Middle Eastern countries that ally against Iran and with Europe. There's a little more nuance to it than that, but specifically in the prophecies mentioned the Ishmaelites or the Peninsular Arabs. And to this point, they have been squabbling in and among themselves, probably more than anything. Qatar famously had the blockade around it. The UAE and Saudi Arabia have had their squabbles in places like Yemen. And with Iran's attacks, all of that seems to have evaporated overnight. And there's other countries too involved in Psalm 83, like Jordan, that are getting involved as well. And Turkey, as I mentioned. So you are very much seeing the battle lines drawn. To this point, a lot of these countries have been trying to be friends with both sides as much as possible. Okay, they host American military bases, but they'll also advocate for Iran for America to not invade Iran before in the United Nations, etc. And Iran knows that. Iran knows that these countries are trying not to get involved in the fray, and it still attack them as severely as Iran did. And I think this burnt a lot of bridges between the two sides. I don't think there's really any return to the status quo prior to the war. I think this has forced the Arab countries to pick a side, and it's not Iran.
And I think it's a similar story from Europe, where part of that Psalm 83 alliance is that it's led by Germany. It's an alliance that brings these Arab countries together with Europe. And we've seen a Europe that stays detached from President Trump's bombing of Iran. There's a lot of conflict within Europe about even how to respond. Spain is dead against it. I think, you know, people are torn. A lot of European leaders are torn. A lot of European countries, the populace, they do not like Donald Trump. They don't like Iran either. And so you have had quite a few muddled responses in a lot of ways. But the one thing that Europe has been absolutely united on has been a few locations in the Middle East that they're really moving very quickly to defend. So one of these is Cyprus, where, you know, like you mentioned at the start, and you said I'd have more to say about it. Indeed, I do. You have one drone, I think it was initially, hitting British sovereign territory. The bases in Cyprus are British territory. They're not part of the country of Cyprus. Yet, this has led to a much more dramatic response from Europe than it has from Britain. Part of that is Britain's weakness. Our Royal Navy is in a woeful condition. The government is so divided. It's kind of afraid of all the migrants that it's let in. It didn't want to seem like it was supporting the attack in any way, so it kind of pulled all of its assets out of the area, so we had nothing to go send to defend Cyprus. But, you know, after this base was hit, the Cypriot president turned to Europe. He was very critical of the UK, and he immediately made phone calls. You know, the attack came local time. It was shortly after midnight, just kind of gone from Sunday into Monday, so very early Monday morning. In Britain time, it was Sunday. It's led to a little bit, made it quite hard to get the exact timing on the attack. But anyway, Monday, and so that day, the Cypriot president is calling European leaders. He talked to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who very strongly backed Cyprus. The Greeks announced the same day that they would be sending two frigates and several F-16 fighters, and one of their ships, the Chimon, you'd know how to pronounce that in Chimon.
Like, if you see a CH, like, it's generally fine to just pronounce it without the H.
So the Chimon, it's Greece's most advanced frigate. It entered into service just the end of last year. I think it only basically arrived in Greece for the first time late December. So brand new ship that arrived on Wednesday. So they sent that right away. France responded really quickly. They sent a frigate that Emmanuel Macron announced on Tuesday that it was due to arrive the same day. So presumably that arrived later the day on Tuesday. He also announced that France was moving its entire aircraft carrier strike group from the Baltic to the Eastern Mediterranean. And France is the only power in the world right now, other than the United States, to operate a nuclear aircraft carrier. And it's now on the way to the Eastern Mediterranean to defend Cyprus. And there's a lot of other ships that go with this strike group. The Cypriot president, he also called the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz on Monday, asking for a German frigate. The response so far, or what we know, is that Merz apparently responded positively, but they're still working on a formal decision. For something like that, they're probably looking to it for a more long-term commitment from Germany. You know, Greece, France, these have Baltic coastlines. They can get ships there quickly. Greece and France, they have Mediterranean coastlines. They can get there quickly. Germany has a Baltic coastline. It doesn't have a Mediterranean coastline. I think Greece or Cyprus knows it's going to take longer for a German warship to come up. So I think it's more of a long-term commitment they're looking for from Germany. The Netherlands has a ship en route. Spain, that again, very critical of the bombing, but they're sending a ship to go and back Cyprus. So you see Cyprus, you know, very deliberately saying we're looking to Europe, and then Europe just having an overwhelming response. People are starting to talk about, whoa, the waters around Cyprus are going to get quite crowded now. I mean, this in some ways is kind of a bonkers level of defense to send for Iran, or it was more like Hezbollah, I think, and Iranian proxies in Lebanon. It was like three drones. One reportedly that hit the base and didn't do any substantial damage and killed no one. Two were intercepted en route. So, like, yeah, okay, do a little more to make sure that nothing gets through, but this is sledgehammer to crack a nut type of response from Europe. But it's because they really want to send a message. We are the defenders of Cyprus. Cyprus, you know, don't look to Britain. Britain has these bases on Cyprus, but it can't defend them. It's a British boat that we've decided to send. It's still in dry dock. They're finishing some welding or something. It's not going to be there for a couple of weeks. So how much longer is Cyprus going to tolerate British bases that bring Cyprus under attack? This was the only reason Cyprus was attacked. But then Britain lacking the ability to defend them, saying, well, yeah, we can get a warship to you in a couple of weeks. I read an article this morning making the comparison to the Falklands War, which it was Britain withdrawing ships from the South Atlantic that precipitated that war. But at least when Margaret Thatcher's looking at, okay, Argentina has just invaded the Falkland Islands, what do we do? Well, the Navy could say we can have a carrier strike team assembled within 48 hours and on the way. Here, 2 weeks and it's one boat. Massive decline in the Royal Navy. And so the EU is stepping up and saying, look to us. And so the Cypriot government is saying that they're doing everything they can to, quote, communicate our dissatisfaction to the United Kingdom. They were asked about if they'd seek to renegotiate the status of Britain's bases there. They said, in this context, we're not ruling anything out. And clearly, Cyprus is looking to the EU for protection. How long they tolerate those bases being British and not European. And this is not a status quo that can last for very long. And these are very valuable real estate for the Middle East. It's not just these being air bases. It's an intelligence gathering platform. This is shared with the United States. Edward Snowden's leaks about a decade ago showed how much the NSA was involved here. There was one of these leaked emails talked about how the NSA has regarded it as a jewel in the crown because by the NSA, as it offers unique access to the Levant, North Africa, and Turkey. those, you can be sure that Cyprus's intelligence gathering platforms have been used a lot over the last week, are used in the planning of these strikes, maybe used in Israel intercepting some of these missiles incoming. Europe would love to have control of those resources on Cyprus. And I think this week they're making a bid to get it, and they're showing why they think Britain should not deserve to have them.
This reminds me a lot of when we were talking about Greenland not that long ago. Okay, maybe President Trump shouldn't have said or did everything he did about Greenland, but Europe's response was to basically cement Greenland over and send this military influence over there that they could not have gotten away with if there wasn't all of this diplomatic flurry going on. I think with Cyprus, this is something they would have wanted a long time ago, but if they did this during peacetime, it would have looked very suspicious, like just with all these ships going in and all this and all these diplomatic problems. But now they're able to do this and nobody's paying attention because everybody's looking at what's happening on the other side of the Middle East. In regards to Cyprus, Mr. Fleury has pointed over and over again that Cyprus is going to play a key role in Europe moving into the Middle East and Europe having the capability of launching this whirlwind attack. And almost overnight, that prediction is happening right now.
It's a good comparison with Greenland. And the other area where you see this is Lebanon, which also, after October 7th and then the aftermath of that and everything going on, Mr. Fleury had a lot to say about Lebanon and a lot to say about Cyprus and about how Europe was going to take advantage of the opportunities presented in the post-October 7th world to move into these two places. And that's exactly what you see going on after the Iranian attack. So Lebanon, Israel has invaded Lebanon. You've had a ground force there. There have been strikes now hitting southern suburbs south of Beirut where Hezbollah has dug in. And the Lebanese president called France to help deal with this and asked Emmanuel Macron, can you talk to the Americans? Can you talk to the Israelis? We'd like to work something out where the strikes in southern Beirut stop. We want to have some kind of ceasefire. Can you work this out? And France is selling Lebanon, I think, armored personnel carriers, and they're offering logistics support. So they're sending in more resources into that region. Both of these places, like I said, exactly the areas that Mr. Fleury drew attention to. And he has had a whole lot to say about Cyprus. 2019, Cyprus was on the front cover of our Trumpet print, and he talked about how, in the wake of Brexit and other things like that, he said, well, I forecast that Britain is going to lose control of those bases on Cyprus. And he said that means it's only a matter of time before the United States is pushed out as well. And that, I think, is what you're seeing these events building to. And this is all part of the King of the North, King of the South prophecy, really. This is about Europe moving into and moving towards the Middle East. And if you are in Europe and you want to project power to the Middle East, Cyprus is super critical for that. As an unsinkable aircraft carrier, as an intelligence gathering platform, as you've got an island that's quite high up that enables you to have quite a long direct line of sight over a lot of the Middle East. It's much more of a reliable European partner than, say, Turkey is, that's a Muslim country. A European power wanting to get more involved in the Middle East, they're absolutely going to want to move in to Cyprus. And really, Daniel 11, it's about this clash between this King of the North, this European empire, and the King of the South, radical Islam led by Iran. But right at the heart of this clash is Jerusalem. It talks about the King of the North entering into the glorious land. It talks about him, it says in verse 45 of Daniel 11, he shall plant his tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. That's what these powers are fighting for and fighting over. Iran wants control of Jerusalem. We see that with their regime right now. They have the Quds Force, which is just Arabic for Jerusalem. The overseas branch of their military is called the Jerusalem Force. And so that's where their focus is, and Europe's focus is there as well. And so they're moving into Cyprus as a stepping stone to getting there. And that's a role Cyprus has played in history before as a crucial stepping stone for European crusades into the Middle East. So this is okay, in some ways you can understand people, or you can say, well, is this prophecy moving in the opposite direction? America taking care of Iran, going in there, dealing with this radical government. But even while this is happening, A, we're forecasting that radical government will stay in place, but B, you're seeing Europe prepare to get more involved and take this opportunity of chaos to build up their involvement in the Middle East. And then, like you said, Mihailo, you've got the SAM 83 alliance, this alliance of Arab nations that Europe is going to work with, both in confronting Iran and then in establishing their control over Jerusalem. That's coming together as well. So the Iran story, massively significant for the world, massively significant prophetically. There are also other events that have happened in this week that we do need to make sure that we take note of. We'll hit just the most important, but we'll just cover some of those briefly as we wind down. So first of all, maybe we'll go back to Andrew. And we've had some significant developments in another longstanding anti-American regime, and this time one much closer to the United States.
Yeah, if President Trump's hoping to enact regime change, his chances of doing so are much better in communist Cuba than they are in Islamic Iran. We've talked on this program before how pretty much since the beginning of the year, since January 3rd, President Trump, he's seized control of Venezuelan oil and put Cuba under embargo. The country's swiftly running out of oil. They're having blackouts. The State Department has agreed to sell for the United States to resell Venezuelan oil to Cuba, but only to private companies, not to state-owned companies. That means that private companies have to exist. And the Cuban government's already taking steps towards the end, with the Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, coming out this week and talking to his board of ministers, saying that we need immediate restructuring of the Cuban economy and resizing of the Cuban government. And when he says resizing, he means downsizing. So he's already looking at downsizing the size of the communist dictatorship and allowing more free market reforms so that private enterprise can exist and the U.S. can sell oil to those enterprises. And so if Donald Trump keeps up that pressure, we could see a regime change or maybe, if not that far, at least dramatic regime reform in Cuba this year, which is also quite prophetic. Mr. Fleury, he's written in his past articles on Cuba that Cuba is actually prophesied to be part of the Holy Roman Empire's economic besiegement of America, because it's right there at the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico, or Gulf of America now, where like half of U.S. seaborne trade comes in, that Cuba is going to have to align itself more closely with Europe. But for that to happen, it kind of needs to break some of its alliances with communist in China and in Russia and in Venezuela and other parts. So that's the long-term view of this. So we aren't necessarily seeing Cuba align with Europe just yet, just like we're not seeing Europe push at Iran just yet. But we are seeing the Trump administration's actions actually at least pull Cuba back closer into the Western world so those prophecies can be fulfilled. And then two other quick stories, just to give a round out view of Anglo-American news this week. Donald Trump also did probably the biggest shakeup in his administration since he's taken the oath of office, firing Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. She's been under investigation basically for mishandling the Minnesota protest, for using DHS funds to buy like private jets and things like that. even for an extramarital affair with one of her staffers. And I don't know how many of those allegations are true, but they're becoming a big enough inconvenience that Donald Trump has decided to fire her from that position, kind of give her another position as a special envoy to the Western Hemisphere, whatever that means. And then actually take one of our own Oklahoma State senators from here in Oklahoma City as the new head of the Department of Homeland Security in charge with enforcing border security here in the United States. And then, yeah, I guess one last one. Australia and Canada also signed a new critical minerals deal. Not sure what's going to come of that yet, but it's a trend I watch closely. One of our last infographics about the economic besiegement of the United States that Cuba is going to be a part of highlights the fact that together the U.S. and Canada are energy self-sufficient and they are food self-sufficient. Makes them uniquely capable of withstanding a long military siege, but they are not mineral self-sufficient, especially rare earth minerals, other things like that. This is really where foreign enemies need to hit the United States. It's one of the reasons the Plain Truth, all the way back in the 1960s, was saying that Latin America would be part of the siege because America gets so many of its minerals from Latin America. They said Latin America and Europe teaming up against the U.S. Would economically starve the United States. And so this new business deal isn't about Latin America or Europe. It's about other Israelite nations, Canada and Australia, taking moves to just highlight their mineral security. Maybe these moves will turn out positive. Maybe they'll for the United States. Maybe they'll turn out negative for the United States. It's just a story to watch just because, yeah, so those ever since the 1960s, we've really been the news bureau associated with Mr. Armstrong and his successor, Mr. Fleury, has really been highlighting critical minerals as a way that foreign nations can isolate the United States from resources it desperately needs.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew and Mihailo. And I've got one more story from Europe that I think this would be leading the show off had it not been for the Iran war, a pretty huge story where French President Emmanuel Macron announced some pretty dramatic changes to France's nuclear doctrine. Really, he's opening up France to sharing its nuclear weapons across the European Union. He said that France is going to expand its nuclear arsenal. It's going to be building more nuclear bombs. It's going to be less transparent. It's not going to publish the amount of nuclear bombs that it has. And it will be open to doing what the United States currently does, where America puts its nuclear bombs in other countries. France is going to start doing that for Europe. I don't think he said he would go quite so far as the United States in terms of letting other nations carry them on their aircraft. They would still be to go on French aircraft. But it's establishing France as really the foundation of a European-wide nuclear deterrence. Politico called them some of the most significant changes in French nuclear doctrine since the end of the Cold War. Die Welt wrote, Macron seized the opportunity to announce nothing less than a reorganization of European deterrence, and he makes his partners an offer that will probably be one of the most far-reaching decisions of his presidency. He mentioned that he'd already reached out to Germany and, well, he called Germany their essential partner, and that the two had started talking about having French nuclear bombs within Germany. And maybe you could have a situation even where Germany contributes some money towards France's nuclear program and gets some enhanced protection, say. That seems very euphemistic when we're talking about nuclear bombs, but from France's nuclear umbrella. And this is, Mr. Fleury has just a great article from several years ago, France's Deadly Ignorance About Germany, from the summer of 2024. But he's been talking about this since all the way back in 1997, talking about the way that France, even back then, was talking about working with Germany on this nuclear issue and loaning them nuclear bombs. He said, well, what is motivating the French to share this frightening power with such a dangerous ally? He says, first of all, everyone knows that Germany is the only economic superpower in Europe, so the French leadership must hope to gain in this area. But do they also fear the Germans? They certainly could reason that this security pact would at least help protect them from a rearmed Germany. And it says, is France being duped by this special relationship with Germany? The whole world is very aware of Germany's military past. However, if France can lead the way in gaining nuclear power for Germany, few people would be alarmed. I mean, this is part of what France is doing. They're enabling and powering Germany. I think a big part of this now as well, and I'm writing on this for the website to go up next week, is that France is afraid of being irrelevant within the European Union. For a lot of Europe's history, Germany has been the economic power and France has been the military power. For the post-war history, I mean. Now you're getting Germany that is massively outspending France, like not just a little more. We're talking about double, getting on close over the next 5 years to three times by the time you get to 2030. Not quite, but close to three times what France is spending. So they need to put something on the table. I think that's partly why they've responded so dramatically to Cyprus. They're really making a big advertisement for France's naval forces. And Germany, you know, the Germany's spending, they're aiming to be the largest conventional army, but France does have a much longer maritime tradition and potentially much more to bring to the table when it comes to the Navy than Germany does. And then nuclear weapons, that they have these nuclear bombs. And so they're basically just offering more and more to Germany in an attempt to still have a seat at the top table and to at least kind of try and pretend that it's a Franco-German marriage that is driving Europe rather than just Germany alone. Really, I think Germany does dominate, but France is trying to stay relevant there. So an important story is Germany, as France works to give a united Europe, a united nuclear force. And again, you can learn more about that in Mr. Flurry's article, France's Deadly Ignorance of Germany. I mean, he gets into France's biblical background in Bible prophecy and the way that Reuben, who Mr. Armstrong talks about in the United States and Britain and prophecy being France, they failed to stand up for their brother Joseph anciently. And that's going to happen again. And they'll be aghast to see what Germany does with the power that they've loaned them. But it'll be too late. And they will have empowered Germany for far too long. And you can see a lot of that happening already. So again, the France's deadly ignorance about Germany talks about what is coming next in that relationship. Well, we've also had some significant developments within Asia that also don't necessarily have or directly related to Iran, some other events that we do need to pay attention to, and we'll get the latest on those from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. The big story that I wanted to talk about is that China's hatred of Taiwan is intensifying. We see this in political speeches and in state media. It's really reaching a fever pitch. And it's not because of territory, and it's not because of some ancient maps from a bygone dynasty. The real reason why China increasingly hates Taiwan is because Taiwan stands as glaring proof against everything that the Chinese Communist Party needs the Chinese people to believe. So one of the main things that the Chinese Communist Party needs its people to believe is that democracy does not and cannot work, especially for the people of China. And they need them to believe that an authoritarian government, such as the Chinese Communist Party, is the only type of regime that can really give the Chinese people stability and success. This is a major theme in the speeches of Chinese leader Xi Jinping and other Communist Party leaders. They love to highlight problems with democracy. They're always ridiculing the inefficiency and the chaos of certain democratic systems because they need the Chinese to think democracy could never work for them, or else they know that the Chinese people could try to reject the Communist Party's extremely authoritarian and oppressive governance. So it's a major problem for China that just 100 miles off of their coast, there lies a chilling rebuke to all of these claims. And that, of course, is Taiwan. Taiwan's people are economically and politically and socially thriving significantly beyond China's people. Taiwan's GDP per capita is 3 times higher than China's. Their healthcare is better and more accessible, which means the average Taiwanese person lives years longer than the average Chinese person. And then Taiwan's low corruption levels and high generosity levels help to push it into the World Happiness Report's top 5th globally. Meanwhile, China doesn't even break into the top half. And all of this is accomplished by the will of Taiwan's people, since it is a robust liberal democracy with, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of internet, all those things that are the very antithesis of China's hyper-restrictive model. And this China-Taiwan comparison is made even more stark by the fact that these are all basically the same people ethnically. You know, the Chinese Communist Party wants the people of China to think that they are fundamentally incompatible with democracy at a cellular level somehow. But Taiwan's people share the same Han Chinese ancestry as China's main people. The two lived together on the mainland until just a few generations ago. So how can it be that the ethnically Chinese people of Taiwan are living so successfully when they don't have authoritarian overlords monitoring them and dictating their every move? How is it that they are not only surviving without the Chinese Communist Party's repressive governance, but outperforming those who are under that governance? How is it that they were able to transition from authoritarianism, which Taiwan used to be up until the mid to late 80s, to democracy, and to do so with minimal turmoil, and to emerge stronger, healthier, and happier as a result? All of those kinds of questions, those are the type of thing that the Chinese Communist Party recoils away from the mere suggestion of. And yet, there lies Taiwan, right off of their coast, making these kinds of questions and comparisons all but inevitable. So this is at the heart of why the Chinese Communist Party longs to destroy Taiwan. And what's alarming is that at the same time as China's hatred of Taiwan is intensifying, Taiwan's most important security backer is wavering in its commitment to protect Taiwan's independence. That is, of course, the United States. New reports this week say that the Trump administration does appear to be canceling or at least delaying a massive weapons sale to Taiwan. President Trump apparently doesn't want to risk upsetting the Chinese and maybe losing the fragile trade truce that China and the U.S. have established. So this sale is now very much in question. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has long said that Taiwan will soon be absorbed by China, that that example of a thriving democracy that the Chinese hate so much will eventually be destroyed. And Mr. Flurry has said that it will happen because of what he calls, quote, a pitifully weak-willed America. And he bases his understanding of this whole dynamic on Bible prophecy, and especially a passage in Leviticus 26 that says America in the modern era would not have the will to use its power. So the days of Taiwan's freedom are numbered, he says. And if anyone would like to understand the China-Taiwan-U.S. dynamic and Mr. Flurry's assessment of it, we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that lays it all out very plainly.
How much do you think this view as well ties in with this kind of mandate of heaven view of history that you have? Like, perhaps this makes this especially relevant to China, where you've talked about this before, where traditionally in the kind of Confucian type telling of Chinese history, you have if a dynasty does good things, they have the mandate of heaven and they prosper. And if they have floods and disease and invasion, then that's clearly evidence that they've lost the mandate of heaven and that they're ripe for overthrow. I mean, if you have a successful Taiwan, does that imply that they have the mandate of heaven? And I mean, China, they're officially atheists, but I think you've written before about how some of that thinking does still kind of carry into Chinese communism and the thinking with a lot of individuals within China today.
Yes, I think that's a very valid question for sure. And I think it's fascinating that You know, under the communists, we saw a lot of the old Confucian thought kind of abolished. We saw a lot of traditional religious-leaning thought abolished. But more recently, China has started to rehabilitate some of that. Confucius is back. He's okay in some aspects. But one thing that we have not seen the Chinese Communist Party rehabilitate is the old view of the mandate of heaven. This belief that when things are going bad, that means the quote-unquote gods are against the current ruler and he should be replaced by someone else. That view, that ancient, you know, doctrine, you could call it, has not been rehabilitated because things are not going great for China. Economically, they're really in the doldrums, grappling with very serious problems in their real estate sector in particular, and of course, trade wars and myriad problems across the board. So I think that for those reasons, the Chinese leadership doesn't want the people to remember the mandate of heaven.
Well, thank you for that that story, Jeremiah. It is an important reminder of how much China wants Taiwan, and just the broad, that it's not just about strategic real estate and geopolitics, but just some very deep-rooted determination to take that location. Did you have any other stories from Asia to bring us?
Yes. First up, another quick China story about some complications that the Chinese are experiencing because of disruptions to their oil supplies from Iran. So Iran, of course, as we discussed throughout the whole show, is under attack right now from the U.S. and Israel. And this has ended up really restricting the oil imports that China depends on so heavily to fuel its economy. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 45% of China's oil usually comes to it through the Strait of Hormuz. So this war is causing serious disruptions for China, and it was no surprise this week to see the Chinese petitioning the Iranians to allow crude shipments and certain gas shipments to get to China despite the conflict. So oil prices are already rising, and the Chinese are understandably concerned about how this might play out. It's a major vulnerability for the Chinese, because if they're not able to get these oil deliveries back up to speed or replace what they're missing from Iran from other nations, it could put major strain on the already straining Chinese economy. And then one final story here about Russia. And Russia is assisting Iran in the war against the U.S. and Israel. This was reported just this morning in the Washington Post. And specifically, it is targeting information that the Russians are sharing with the Iranians, according to this report. This war on Iran is, of course, a setback for Russia. Iran has emerged as one of Russia's most important allies in recent years, supplying Russia with tens of thousands of suicide drones for use in its war against Ukraine. Iran has also given Russia technical support and large quantities of munitions, and Iran has helped Russia to evade sanctions as well. And now it's unlikely that Iran will have much weaponry available to help Russia anymore. So the war on Iran is detrimental to Russia and Russian interests. And that's why I think Russia is now helping Iran to target U.S. forces. We've seen Iran over the last few days make some very precise hits on early warning radars and over the horizon radars and some other important US assets. And it's unlikely that Iran would have been able to do that on its own. So this is almost certainly because of help from Russia's intelligence. And this is quite significant because it is the first indication that another major American enemy is participating in the Iran war. And of course, Russia is nuclear armed. So this development shows the potential for the war to expand, and it shows, I think, the potential for Iran to withstand this American and Israeli attack and to kind of punch above its weight in this war, you know, with Russia now having Iran's back, giving advanced intel. The goal of the Americans and the Israelis is considerably complicated.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah, and to all of our guests on today's show. Thank you to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production today. Lots to talk about, particularly in the Middle East, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to some of these things, like the implications for the energy market and what that means for the world next week. But the King of the South book is just a great place to go to see what is happening here. That just watch, you know, this is, you can watch over the next week or two and longer as well to watch the prophecy that is described in that book fulfilled. That you're not going to have a mini America set up in the Middle East in Iran. So I just encourage you, take that chance. Get that book now so that you can, and read it now so you can watch the Bible come to life in the days ahead. And as you know, we also emphasize, there's the blessings and cursings chapter, the United States and Britain in prophecy is key to understanding why America isn't receiving the massive blessings and the incredible success that it's had so much in the past. King of the South for the Middle East, United States and Britain in prophecy, and for understanding Britain and America, just foundational pieces to understand what is happening in the world. And we would be very happy to send you free copies of those. You can just get them from our website, thetrumpet.com. Any questions, any comments, any difficulties getting those books and booklets, just please do get in touch with us. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We've got more exciting interviews lined up for you for our Wednesday shows. We'll have those shortly. You can look forward to that next week. And until then, keep watching your world.